Good evening. It's good to see you again this evening. I have a question. I want to see how many of you remember from our first message last night what this stands for. PBPGINFWMY. What does it say? Please be patient. God is not finished with me yet. You remember we spent some time last evening in our first message looking at that black sheep in the family story, the story of Judah. You remember? Turn to chapter 38 of Genesis, because here was a long litany of devastating decisions, disaster and death, a complex catalog of catastrophic choices of selfishness, seduction and sin, how Judah forsook the faith of his fathers, how he gave up on the God of his great-grandfather Abraham, how he formed a fellowship with that foreigner who was an infidel, how he contracted a contra-faith conjugal connection with a Canaanite woman. He failed in his fatherly duties. The result was reprobate, rebellious sons, two of whom died. He deceives his daughter-in-law. He propositions whom he believes is a prostitute. It turns out to be his daughter-in-law. Later on, she's pregnant. He condemns her right away. But our message ended with a hint of hope. Genesis 38, verse 26. We ended with that hint of hope last evening as we had our first in this series, as we are looking at what we can learn from this incredible story, the life of Judah. And verse 26 there says, when they brought her out, remember, so Judah acknowledged them, the signet, the cord and the staff, and said, she has, this is the New King James, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah my son. As we explained, he is saying, actually, as the New Jerusalem Bible puts it, she was right and I was wrong. And the rest of the verse says, and he never knew her again, or the NIV, he never slept with her again. The beginning of a change in the life of Judah. But the question still remains, why would God inspire what some might consider the airing of dirty laundry? Do you know what I'm talking about? They say, don't air your dirty laundry before everybody. And here is a story that, in a sense, is the airing of dirty laundry. Now, you will remember in our first message, I said there were three words we wanted to come back to. Who remembers what those three words were? Chapter 38, verse 1. I said we're going to go back to three words in chapter 38, verse 1. Three critical words which helps to set the stage. What were those three words? At that time. Yes, you're with me. At that time. And we're going to look at those three words. What does at that time mean? It came to pass, chapter 38, verse 1, at that time that Judah departed from his brothers. At what time? Where are we in the course of history? Now, that time apparently refers to two things. The first thing is you look at the verse right before that, verse 36 of chapter 37. Chapter 37, verse 36 says, now the Midianites had sold him. Who's him? Joseph, in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard. So at what time is the story taking place? At about the same time that Joseph is being sold into slavery. Yes. But there's another at that time. You have to go back about seven more verses. First, go up two verses before that. Chapter, just to 34. Go to verse 34. We mentioned it also. Then Jacob tore his clothes. Remember that? Put sackcloth on his waist and mourned for his son many days. And 35, all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted. And he said, I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Let me ask you a question. They mourned in ancient times. How long did they mourn? Forever? This was extravagant. In fact, when we get to the end of the book of Genesis and Jacob dies, how long does Joseph and his brothers mourn for him? Only 7 days. Here, Jacob says, I'm going to mourn for the rest of my life. So he is weeping and wailing and crying continuously. And why does Judah leave? Notice, he's the only one who leaves. Go back about five or so more verses. Go back 10 verses to verse 24. You get the background. 10 verses, you get to verse 24. Then they took him, who's the him, and cast him into the pit. That was Joseph. Remember, he had arrived. They took him, cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And by the way, then they sat down to eat while he was starving and going to die. Incidentally, Joseph had traveled something like 65 miles to get to his brothers. All the way from Hebron, all the way up 50 miles to Shechem. Shechem, yes, you remember, Jacob had purchased a field there, and the brothers were out there on the field that their father had purchased some time before. You find that in Genesis chapter 33, he bought a field. Well, after going, they went up from Shechem up to Dothan, another 15 miles. Joseph eventually found them. He was so glad to see them. Of course, they were angry when he arrived because they said, here comes that dreamer, the favored son of our father. And so they threw him into the pit only because Reuben had stepped in time. Now go to verse 26 because now some Ishmaelites come along, traitors. Verse 26. So Judah, notice who's speaking. Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother and our flesh. And his brothers, listen now, you ask yourself the question. If he is our brother and our flesh, how can you sell him to these traitors? There was a lot of money involved, by the way, a lot of money. The going price for a slave back then was 20 pieces of silver. Now, that might not sound like much, but when you realize 20 pieces of silver, the shepherds used to earn about 2 pieces of silver for 3 months of work. Now, translate that into today's currency. That's what? 2 months, 3 months of work? $10,000 for two pieces of silver. So every one of the 10 brothers got $10,000 to sell him. They sold him for about $100,000. If you're earning $3,500 or so per month, that's what we're talking about. $100,000. It's a lot of money. So when these brothers sold him for these 2 pieces of silver each, 20 pieces, 10 brothers, Benjamin was back home. He wasn't in on the deal. It's a lot of money they were making off him. And so, of course, what happens when they get back home and the father weeps inconsolably? Guess who feels the most guilty? Judah. Why? It was his idea, under the garb of being kind to Joseph, let's sell him into slavery, which, by the way, slavery in Egypt was a fate worse than death. There's nothing nice about Judah here. Don't misunderstand. Let's be nice. He's our brother. No, it's an excuse to make money. He was a mercenary. We'll get further on the story with Judah. Incredible. So Judah's feeling guilty, folks. At that time, at the time when his father is grieving inconsolably, Judah cannot stand to be home because he's the cause for the son being separated from his father. So what does Judah do? That's why he leaves. I believe that is what caused him to go. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever stepped on someone's toes? Hurt someone? Wronged someone? How do you feel? Especially, and we're Christians, we're Adventists, but we do make mistakes, and sometimes we even do things on purpose to get even. You know what I'm talking about? How do you feel when you've done that? What describes it? One word, right? Guilt. Guilt. Now the question is, guilt is natural, and by God's grace, I hope, not just natural, but spirit-induced guilt. In fact, I even call it God's gift to us. Now, the question is, what do you do? What do you do when you've hurt someone? How do you respond? Remembering that the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked, what do you do? Do you make excuses? I've come across some that were very interesting. You've heard somebody say perhaps, sure, I have my faults. Who doesn't? No one's perfect. Ever said that? Or, oh, that's just the way I am. I came across somebody one day who really had a problem, but that was her excuse. That's my family. That's the way I was raised. That's the way I am. And just left it at that. Someone else says, hey man, I've always had a bad temper. I can't help it. Which in essence denies the power of God. Isn't that true? One of the best or worst excuses I've heard, rationalizations, is this one. I really told her off, but it'll do her a world of good. How we can justify ourselves. I've got to share a story with you. It happened about a decade ago. Personal story, difficult story. I was out in California, At that time, I was a race walker. I was working at Southern Adventist University, and I got into walking, enjoyed it. And I was out in California for about a week or so. First time I had the chance to get into a walk, and if you've seen race walkers, it's serious business. They walk pretty fast. The world record for men for 1 mile of walking is 5 minutes, 31 seconds walking. So that I'm talking about walking. Race walking is serious business, okay? So I was not that very serious. I was kind of just one of the run-of-the-mill people, not an Olympic athlete by any means. But I was here in California. I said, I'm going to go do this race walk. And I went, registered, and one of my students was there and in that area. So I joined the race and I began to walk. However, I hadn't learned how to walk yet. When I say that, I mean, you know, I was, 10 years ago, I was in my early 40s, but I hadn't learned the rules of race walking. There are two rules. And I had one problem. I had bent knees. And sure enough, three judges disqualified me. They were very fair, not just one judge. When three judges say you're not walking properly, they will disqualify you. And about 40% into the race, they said, number so-and-so, you're out. Oh, I felt so dreadful. I felt embarrassed. And so I didn't go back to the starting point. I found a way around so nobody would see me with my race number and everything walking back. I mean, the race is not over. Everybody would know I was disqualified. So I went to my car. I got in my car and I drove. And I know you will relate to this. How do you feel when you've been disqualified? I drove to the nearest Taco Bell. I had to go and make myself feel good. And I remember sitting down and what did I do? I bought two Mexican pizzas. Now, I was a vegetarian, I still am, but I had Mexican pizzas without the meat. And there I sat enjoying my Mexican pizzas with beans on. Oh, and I felt so good, even though I felt so bad. And then I pulled out my packet. Now, every race you go to, they give you a little race packet. I have one here, one of these race packets, just a simple bag. And so I said, well, you know, while I'm eating my pizza, I started pulling out things, and there were some advertisements for a few more races in California, which I never got back to ever again. But so I started nice t-shirt, and as I was going through, I found a little pack that you wear around your waist called a fanny pack, and I looked again, and I pulled out a second one. I said, oh, wonderful, they gave me two. And the moment I realized they gave me two, I had done some races before, not as professional as this one where the judges would disqualify you, you know, just the little hometown ones where they don't even notice your knees are bent when you're walking the wrong way. So I found the second one, and immediately a little something in my brain said, are you sure you're supposed to have two? And instantly I said, I deserve two. They disqualified me. I paid full fee for that race, and they only let me walk 40% of the way. And again, as I ate my Mexican pizza, the voice came back and said, are you sure you're supposed to have two? And then I looked at my watch and I said, oh, I have no time to go back. I'm supposed to meet my student over here in about 15 minutes. The race is way too far away. I cannot get back to return this. Now, I'm sure they plan to give me two of these nice packs. Are you sure you shouldn't take it back? And then I became magnanimous. I said, oh, I have two identical fanny packs. One for my wife and one for me. We'll have matching ones. And that voice kept bothering me, brother and sister, until I said, okay, basically, I'll go back. And so I jumped in my car and I drove back quietly to the race that had by now ended because I had been enjoying my Mexican pizzas. And I snuck into the back of the building quietly. I didn't want to make a big scene. And I walked up to the table there. They were handing out awards. And I said, excuse me, ma'am, did you folk intend to give me two of these little packs? She said, no, we didn't. She said, but you can have the second one for $5. I said, no, thanks. That's okay with me. Thank you very much. And the moment I said thank you, I sat down. It was like a weight off my shoulders. You know what I'm talking about? Okay. We all find the most interesting ways to rationalize away our guilt. We even become magnanimous. Oh, I'll have one for my wife. I'll give it to the poor or whatever. Oh, I look back on my own story and I think, wow. The question is, what do you do? In the Bible, there are many stories. We're just going to remind you of some of them quickly. How did people in the Bible respond and react when they faced sin and guilt? You remember Adam and Eve in Genesis 3? What did they do? They fled and they hid. I call that the isolation reaction. Trying to get away from God. What does David say? You cannot flee from God. But sometimes we try to hide away or hide away from people. You know why? We don't want to see the people whom we've hurt. Isn't that true? It makes us feel guilty. A second one is a well-known one, the story of Saul. And by the way, Saul started out as a good man. God chose him to be the king. We often think of Saul as this terrible king. He was a good guy. He was chosen because he was outstanding. But he became further, he moved further and further away from God, sacrilegious sacrifices, disobeying God when it came to following his instructions. And so what did Saul do? Eventually, it says that a distressing spirit of the Lord came over him. In simple terms, his conscience bothered him. What did he do? Did he make things right? No. He called for music. Found David, said, there's a harp, bring music to soothe his troubled soul. Now, I have a question for you and me. We don't have harpists who we can order to come in because we aren't kings. We don't have a David around here. But I was reading in a book recently, you know what it says? We, to have our troubled consciences be not heard, turn on the radio. We have music going wherever we are. When we're in the house, we've got the television on. Every waking moment, there must be something happening so that our consciences won't be reminding us of that which we need to fix up. Interesting. So we don't bring in a harpist, but we sometimes have the same reaction. I call that the compensation reaction. We try to fill the void. We don't flee, we try to fill the void. Because we cannot stand that voice. Of course, there was David himself. You remember David when he sinned with Bathsheba, 2 Samuel chapter 12, got Uriah killed. He tried all kinds of things. Of course, Nathan the prophet came along. And what did David say when that parable was told? He said, that man deserves to die. Now, when I was growing up in South Africa, we used to have an interesting saying, the pot is calling the kettle what? Black. You've heard that. Here is a classic case of the pot calling the kettle black. What you have done wrong, you find quickest to condemn in someone else. And here is what I call the condemnation reaction. You condemn others so that you don't look bad. And this is all the danger that we face. One more quick example. The counselor to David, his name was Ahithophel. Incidentally, he was the grandfather of Bathsheba. Ahithophel, the counselor of David, was Bathsheba's grandfather. And apparently, he was unhappy with what had happened with Bathsheba. So when Absalom had his rebellion, guess what Ahithophel did? Ahithophel joined the rebellion of Absalom and left David, abandoned David, to whom he had given counsel for a long time. And David realized he was in trouble because Ahithophel was a brilliant counselor. So David sends Hushai to try to cause a problem and try to discount Ahithophel's instructions. Ahithophel does give Absalom good counsel, by the way, in his rebellion. Hushai comes along and discounts Ahithophel. Ahithophel feels so bad because he has lost out with David. Now he's lost out with Absalom. And he is just a loser. Instead of saying, hey, I have sinned. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done this. What does he do? He goes and, quote unquote, puts his house in order and goes and hangs himself. The desolation reaction. It's true, folks. Some people suffer from guilt so badly. What do? Kill themselves. Suicide. The ultimate attempt to get rid of guilt. The desolation one. The question I have for you this evening is, how do I react? Now let's look at Judah again. What did Judah do? I want you to see this. I believe Judah tried different methods. Number one, he tried the isolation one. Look at verse 1. It came to pass at that time that Judah went down. Remember, he departed. He fled. First thing, let's get away from this place which is making me feel too guilty. I can't stand to be near my father. I cannot stand to hear that. Judah fled. Isolation reaction. Not only that, what did he do next? He tried to fill his life with all kinds of things. Parties, yes, he did have that. You find that the sheep shearers, pleasure, he kept looking for that. He tried to fill his life with stuff to keep him busy. But not only that, we find him with a condemnation reaction when Tamar comes out and they say she is pregnant. And he says what? Burn her. Judah has the same kind of reactions. But thank God that the story of Judah shows us what I call the best reaction of all. When Tamar says the person to whom these things belong is the one who is the Father. What does Judah do? Now, what could he have done? Stop for a moment. Judah was the patriarch of that area. He was in charge. He was the father-in-law, and he was still in charge of Tamar. Do you know what he could have done? He could have said, "Oh, for 3 months I have looked for my staff. I have hunted everywhere for my seal and my cord. I should have known this woman who has been the cause of the death of my two sons, Ur and Onan. I should have known not to trust her. When I went out to the sheep shearers up in Timnah with my friend Hira, I should have known she would come and find my stuff and steal them." Could he have done that? Yes, he could have. He could have concocted another story to try to get out of it. But thank God that Judah went to what I call the humiliation reaction. The humiliation reaction, that's where we need to be. Because only when we are humbled, then we will confess and make things right. And that is when spiritual revival can begin. Let me show you the evidence, and I'm going to jump ahead in the story, because we have to still track that later on. I want to show you that Judah is fully aware that he is guilty. He even uses that word. And he is aware of it, and he recognizes it, and we'll come to one more place where he is going to confess it publicly about, guess what? About selling Joseph. We'll get to that. Fascinating. Just go to chapter 42 for right now. A couple of hints I want you to see here. Firstly, chapter 42. Remember, this by the time is when Joseph had thrown them all into prison in Egypt. The first trip they came down, they were in prison for 3 days in jail. And now they are just being released to go back. And Simeon is still being kept in prison. And notice what happens here in chapter 42. All right, you'll find in verse 17. So he put them all together in prison 3 days. Then he releases them, right? And notice verse 21. Then they said to one another. They're talking to each other. What do they say? "We are truly guilty concerning our brother." Which brother? Joseph. "We're guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." We're guilty. All right? We shouldn't have treated him that way. One more quick example of their recognition of their guilt. Chapter 44. Now Judah himself is speaking. Again, we're jumping ahead of the story. I want you to see hints of the fact that Judah is willing to say this. And by the way, this story, chapter 44, is after Joseph has gotten the cup, his special cup, hidden in Benjamin's sack. They've caught them. They brought them back. And Judah comes now, and here's Judah's speech. And notice verse 16. Chapter 44, verse 16. What does it say? "Then Judah said, 'What shall we say to my Lord?'" By the way, did they steal the cup? No. Did Joseph, who's the governor, and they don't know that the governor is Joseph, right? Did Joseph know that they hadn't stolen the cup? Yes. So they know they haven't stolen it. The governor knows they haven't stolen it. Now notice, though, in that context, you must remember that. He is accusing them of it. Now notice what Judah says. "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants." The New International Version. "God has uncovered your servants' guilt." Wait a minute. They're not guilty. He knows it. The governor knows they're not guilty. And the governor, Joseph, knows that they know they're not guilty. Okay? And yet Judah says, "God has uncovered your servants' guilt." Plural. And the cup was found in whose bag? All of theirs? No, in Benjamin's. And notice what Judah says. "Here we are." We're all guilty. "Here we are, my Lord's slaves. Both we and he also with whom the cup was found." By the way, Benjamin, the cup was found in his sack. But the rest of them were all guilty of selling Joseph. Okay. He says, "We're guilty." Okay, and the guilt he is really remembering, because they know in verse chapter 42, "We're guilty because we didn't treat our brother nicely." He is recognizing his guilt. He had gone through isolation, compensation, condemnation, but he had gotten to the place of humiliation, and Judah is willing to confess, "We are guilty." And by the way, there will be more coming. I will show you incredible evidences of what Judah does as he goes through this spiritual revival. But folks, Guess how long it took him to do this? How long? Think for a moment. Approximately. How many years would you guess from the time that they sold Joseph? Take a guess. 3 years? 30 years? A little less. About 20 to 25. Most commentators come up with about 22 years, and if you add up Joseph's age from the time he left at 17 and the time he becomes governor at 30 and how many years of plenty and how many years of famine, this is the second year of famine. It comes out to be 22 years. 22 years of grief, all because he fled when he had been guilty. 22 years. Turn in your Bibles to James chapter 5, verse 16. God has a word to us, folks. When we are struggling with issues, James chapter 5 verse 16 says so beautifully here by James, who we believe was actually the stepbrother. The evidence is that he was the stepbrother of Jesus himself. James, who became a leader in the early church. James chapter 5 verse 16, well-known passage says, "Confess your trespasses to one another," or as the King James says, "your faults." Or as the American Standard says, your sins, trespasses, false sins. I don't want you to narrow it to, oh, I didn't trespass. It's just a fault. No. Anything where you've hurt somebody. And pray for one another. Why? That you may be what? Healed. That you may be healed. Spiritual healing will come when we do that. Now, for a moment we can say, wait a minute. Hey, come on, pastor. Huh, I'm not like Judah. I haven't forsaken the faith of my fathers. I haven't gone out there and contracted this contra-faith marital situation. I haven't raised rebellious sons. I haven't gone out and propositioned who I thought was a prostitute. Oh no, I'm not guilty. Ah, but the question is, guilt in whose eyes? I found this amazing statement in Steps to Christ, page 30, which brings this whole message home to me and to you. Listen to this. God does not regard all sins as of equal magnitude. There are degrees of guilt, there's the word, in his estimation, as well as in that of man. But however trifling this or that wrong act may seem in the eyes of man, no sin is small in the sight of God. Man's judgment is partial, imperfect, but God estimates all things as they really are. How does he do it? Listen now. Now, this is going to surprise us, and actually it's scary. This statement, the drunkard is despised and is told that his sin will exclude him from heaven. And it's true, right? While, Ellen White says, this is how we reason, while pride, selfishness, and covetousness too often go unrebuked. But these sins, pride, selfishness, covetousness, these are sins that are especially offensive to God. For they are contrary to the benevolence of His character, to that unselfish love which is the very atmosphere of the unfallen universe. He who falls into some of the grosser sins, like Judah, may feel a sense of his shame and poverty and his need of the grace of Christ, but pride feels no need. And so it closes the heart against Christ and the infinite blessings he came to give. Wow. Is the story of Judah for us? Most definitely. Judah had some of the grosser sins, and yet in God's sight, we could suffer from even worse problems. That statement really makes me think. I found a book called Beyond Anxiety that's dealing with the Christian way to deal with guilt. And it talks about this healing process, James 5 verse 16, and it says this, if guilt is covered up in the unconscious mind, it remains. It festers and makes us sick, not only in spirit, but in body as well. Isn't that true? Psychologists will tell you that. Now, somebody says, yeah, but that happened 20 years ago. Or that happened 3 years ago. And you've heard the saying, time heals, you know that statement? What? All wounds. Time heals all wounds. This book, Beyond Anxiety, reads further. Listen carefully. And one thing is sure, time does not heal the wound. Time dulls the conscious memory. But a chance meeting will bring back in full force things we thought had passed out of our lives. same in Judah's life. When they met up with Joseph, when they were treated so roughly and cast into prison, then the memory came back. Time never heals, folks. Time does not heal. The only healing we can find is if we make things right with each other. If we go to the foot of the cross, don't flee from the problem, flee to Jesus Christ. Maybe I have time just for one short story, a story I got to share. It's a story that helped me to learn some important lesson. I also thought time heals. I was a college student around that time, and I had done something wrong. We'll call this person Chris because it could be male or female. Okay? And I thought, well, time heals. And I was at the same church, and Chris and I became friends better. And then I was ready to move to another city, 1,000 miles away. And that little voice reminded me, you might never have a chance to do the right thing, make things right. If you're going to move, it's going to be a long way to come back. I was driving with my cousin one day, and I just felt impressed. As we were driving maybe a mile or two from the house, I said, hey, stop right here. He said, what for? I said, no, I need to get up. I got something I got to do. Thank God I responded to the promptings of the Spirit right then. I jumped out of the car. I walked to that house. I knocked on the door. Chris opened the door, and I simply said, Chris, I've come to say sorry. And Chris kind of surprised me by saying, I've been waiting. And I had thought everything was okay because we were going to the same church. We were fellowshipping there. I thought time had healed. Guess what, folks? Time does not heal. The only healing is when we make things right with each other. And you know what happened? I'll never forget this. It was one of the most incredible feelings. As I turned and left the home of Chris, I actually felt like I had springs under my feet. It was the weirdest thing. Because for about 2 years, I had been carrying this burden of guilt and I'd never known it. I was jumping and leaping and praising God as I left the house. It was the most incredible feeling that I remember because I had carried that heavy burden of guilt so long and I never knew it. And I thank God for that opportunity to make things right. Folks, I believe that guilt is a gift of God. The story of Judah shows that when we respond to that gift of guilt and make things right, we can have a spiritual revival. Let me read you one quick more statement from Ellen White, Sons and Daughters of God, page 302. God reveals to us our guilt. It's a gift of God. Why? That we may flee to Christ. What do you say? Yes, that's the purpose. Not that we may flee running away as Judah did, that we may flee to Christ and through Him be set free from the bondage of sin and rejoice in the liberty of the sons of God. In true contrition, we may come to the foot of the cross and leave there our burdens. Our second message, I believe, is very brief and very precise and concise. The best way, if you look at the life of Judah, to have a spiritual revival is when you see a problem, don't flee. Flee, if any place, to the foot of the cross. Repent by the Holy Spirit's grace and then go and make things right with your brother and your sister. Confess and be healed, because only this way will we be able to enjoy carrying that light burden. Remember Jesus says, come to me, Matthew 11, all ye who are burdened and are heavy laden, and I will give you what? Rest. Jesus will give us the kind of rest that Judah eventually found after more than 2 decades. I challenge you, my brother, my sister, spiritual revival comes when we respond. And remember Ellen White's words, some of the grosser sins we look down on people, but in our own hearts, we might be suffering from other sins, sins that are hidden. And I pray that the way to revival by God's grace is as we confess to God and as we make things right with each other, God will bless us and bring about a transformation and a spiritual revival so that we can be ready to share His love much more effectively with others. That's my prayer. In Jesus' name, amen.
You've been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2004, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. For additional cassettes or CDs by this speaker, or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministries resources, please contact us as follows. Visit our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our entire catalog is online, plus thousands of other selections to choose from. We accept Visa, MasterCard, and Discover credit cards. Our email address is info@americancassette.org. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 800-233-4450. For international orders, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108, in the United States of America. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages for 29 years, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with the finest, most powerful spiritual messages available. Our one purpose in ministry? To prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.